Like, it's possible for a kid to have no care, no passion, no signs of motivation in first hour. And then all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, 5 minute passing time, and they go into their second hour class and they are firing on all cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this replicated again and again in all different contexts. And so what this tells us is beliefs are contextually dependent. And so that means that I do have some power. I can affect these beliefs.
Hey, it's Zach, and I need to interrupt a moment because we are doing an incredibly exciting thing that requires your participation. Once a month, we will be featuring a teacher challenge on an episode and attempting to tackle the challenge between the four of us on the show. We want to hear from you about the challenges you might be facing in your classroom this year. Every teacher featured will receive a gift card, and at the end of the school year, we will draw a name randomly from all those who shared to award a $100 gift card. To share a challenge and earn a chance to win, simply call our number and leave a message. That number is 616-965-6606. Again, 616-965-6606.
This is Transforming Learning.
Welcome back to Transforming Learning. I'm Zach. I'm here with Pete, and we're talking about episode 62. Pete, you were talking with Dave Stewart Jr., who is a favorite on the podcast. Now, give us a little bit of background. Who is this guy?
Well, Zach, our listeners might remember Dave Stewart Jr. from episode 34, when he and I had kind of a long-form conversation, a deep dive into his recently released book, These Six Things. And so today, for today's conversation, we took one of those six things, specifically student motivation, and kind of fleshed that out together. He has compiled what he calls the five key beliefs, and we went through each one and talked about those kind of in depth. So just a little bit more about Dave for some background. So Dave is a world history teacher in Cedar Springs Public Schools, Cedar Springs High School. He has written actually two books now that are published, and he's a speaker and a blogger, and you can find his work at davestewartjr.com.
That's excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I've spent some time myself reading about some of Dave Stewart Jr.'s work and the five key beliefs especially. So very excited to hear what we have in store for the listeners. So here's Pete and Dave.
I am here with Dave Stewart Jr. Dave, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Pete, thank you for having me back on this amazing podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and how are you?
I am great. Excited to be here.
And I'm excited to have you here, Dave. So last time we spoke, we did a pretty comprehensive dive through your recent book, These Six Things. Congrats on the book again, by the way.
Thank you so much, Pete. I really appreciated that conversation we had.
And one of those six things is what I want our topic to be today. So one of the six things is all around student motivation, and specifically the five key beliefs that you've done a lot of work around. And actually, it strikes me that at the end of that conversation, I asked you what's in store for you. And you said, you know, I really want to do some work around the five key beliefs. And so you've done some of that work, and here we are to talk about that today. So, I wonder if you could start, Dave, by giving us kind of the origin story of the five key beliefs and how you've kind of come to think about student motivation.
Yeah, five key beliefs origin story. You know, I knew that when I was writing this book about literacy that there had to be something about the biggest picture stuff, because if I go to an audience, and I've done this around the country, and ask them, hey, picture a kid who's likely to succeed, and then once you picture that kid, come up with a word or two to describe why you think that kid came up in your mind. When I ask people this question, it's like 99% of respondents choose something that has nothing to do with academics, right? They choose dependable or kind or passionate or self-starting or curious or, you know, gritty. There's just all these descriptors that there's not a huge consistency in what that they describe. It's just that they don't describe reading, writing, mathematics, science. They tend to not describe that. And so there's just this commonsensical, intuitive sense in all of us that there's more that matters to long-term flourishing than just academics. And so I knew that I had to treat that, I had to deal with that, because every great educator in the world is trying to affect those other things. And those are things that a lot of the research refers to as like social emotional learning or character strengths or non-cognitive factors. I mean, that's part of the problem too. We have this huge like range of describing this stuff. So for the longest time, Pete, my strategy was, okay, we got to target this stuff directly. You got to target grit. You got to target curiosity, zest. You got to target that. And so how do you target that? But the more that I read in the research, the more I realized that that can be a little bit of a fool's errand, because there's just a million ways to approach that. And for the practicing educator like myself and millions of others out there, it's super overwhelming to try to do on top of what we're trying to teach. And so that's when I started to arrive at these breakthroughs, realizing that, first of all, when students pursue something that's challenging, okay, and when it's especially a meaningful challenge, then all of a sudden what starts to happen is you develop these non-cognitive factors as you go, as you pursue that challenge, okay? And then I started to find that there are ways to make, there are beliefs that if these beliefs exist, then all of a sudden schoolwork can become meaningful. Like world history can become meaningful to a child in 2018 if they have these certain beliefs. And so I started to kind of, it's like this filter came over my glasses, and now I was just seeing these beliefs everywhere. I was seeing it in John Hattie's crazy meta-analyses, and I was seeing it in huge reviews of all the literature and research on non-cognitive factors. And so that was like the origin of the five key beliefs. I realized, no, what we should do is try to teach really appropriately challenging classes all across the school day, helping students to get the best possible benefit from whatever subject area or grade level we've been assigned to teach. But to make that as powerful as possible, we need to just infuse every piece of the work with efforts to cultivate these five key beliefs.
Dave, as I'm listening to you speak about this, there's a flavor of treating the root cause instead of the symptom kind of coming through. So what hit me is we do tend to focus on social, emotional learning, character skills, non-cogs, and potentially those are just some of the things that emanate from the root. I don't even want to say root cause. It's not necessarily a problem, but the root of what's going on inside the child. So this is interesting to kind of get down into the nitty gritty of what's really going on inside of each and every one of our students.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you can have classrooms filled with teachers who are teaching kids how to succeed academically and also teach them about life along the way, right? Like I talked to my ninth grade world history students about hey, you know, have you guys been thinking about what you want to do with your 4 years? I'll do little warm-ups now and then to get them focusing on different careers or different pathways that are available inside of our school. When I have them do like a group conversation or a whole class conversation, I'll talk to them about social skills. You know, so I think we want teachers to teach these non-cogs just like in the context of the academic mastery we're trying to help our students to arrive at. But yeah, then you got to get to this root of, well, what do you do when a kid just doesn't care, right? What do you do when a kid just won't do any of their work, right? Or they do work, but all they care about is a grade.
Right.
Or maybe they do work, but they have no attention to like the quality of that work. And so it's just a really low effect on their achievement. What do you do for that?
Right.
And that starts to get the root of their beliefs.
Yeah. And I think that many of us, I know I did, looking back at my own practice, subconsciously or consciously, mostly subconsciously, would use some of those, oh, that kid doesn't care, as an excuse to not then care about them. What I love about your work here, Dave, is that you're saying, no, that's not an option. That's not what we're doing here. Yes. We've got to drill deeper into what's really going on, and that's part of our job.
Yeah, Pete, exactly, because I mean, this is what I love about this research, which is being done not by people who are like kind of, you know, feel-goody types like me. You know, I tend to be very optimistic, sometimes to a fault. But these researchers, they're approaching this just from a hard science perspective. And what they find is that these beliefs are totally malleable at the classroom right. level. Like, it's possible for a kid to have no care, no passion, no signs of motivation in first hour. And then all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, 5 minute passing time, and they go into their second hour class and they are firing on all cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this replicated again and again in all different contexts. And so what this tells us is beliefs are contextually dependent. And so that means that I do have some power. I can affect these beliefs, even in the hardest cases of kids. Pete, those kids who, you know, our instinct can be like, I just have to not care about that kid because I can't do anything about them. And so,
right.
you know, since I can't do anything about them, it's either I'm going to have to like detach from them, you know, disengage from trying to teach them, or I'm going to go crazy.
Right.
And I want to go crazy, so I have to start to do what you described, Pete, which yeah. I've done too. Just say, yep, that kid, you know, that kid just doesn't care, or that kid's got a hard home life and, you know, nothing I can do.
Yeah, yeah. So let's dive in a bit here. I think that was a good kind of background preamble to the conversation. Is there, first, Dave, is there an order in your mind to these five key beliefs? Is there, sure. in other words, kind of a priority to one over the others?
Yeah, Pete, I think that I'll give you my current thinking, okay which is modified. The thing that hasn't changed for me is that credibility, teacher credibility, the belief that in a child that their teacher is good at their job, that is by far the, like, that's the one belief to rule them all, to steal some Lord of the Rings language. That belief right there, if you can just cultivate that, a lot of your job's going to be easier and more impactful. I think after that, my current thinking would be that the value belief is of first importance. This work matters. This work matters to me. And then you got the belonging belief. People like me do this kind of work. I belong in this classroom, in this academic community of history students or science students. And then you've got effort and efficacy. I can improve at this through my own effort. I can get more knowledgeable, more skillful, and efficacy would be I can succeed at this. Mm-hmm. I can achieve this. So I believe that's the order, because I think if you don't value the work that you're doing, then you're less likely to care if you belong or that your effort can improve your abilities or that you can succeed. If I don't value the work, if I think world history is dumb, and I keep going to world history, that's what I teach. If I think world history is dumb, then who cares if I'm the type of person that does the reading and writing and thinking work of a historian? Who cares, right? Because it's not valuable. So,
yeah.
I mean, even if I think Mr. Stewart's a great teacher, if I don't value it, it doesn't matter. So that's probably the order.
No, that's helpful. I should say I've been using these in my work with adults and the work that I'm always trying to teach yes. adults and students, and yep. and it's been very helpful. I just want to kind of place a flag in that part, and I want to get to some of the utility
yeah.
of these. Like, so when would I think about as a teacher the five key beliefs? But nice. Before we do that, I'm wondering if we can break each one down.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back to use and utility after that, if that sounds okay.
Yeah, that's great.
So, credibility.
Yes.
So, if that's the one belief to rule them all, mm-hmm. what, and maybe a good place to begin would be to say, okay, that makes sense. What can I possibly do,
right.
Dave, if I have a student that I'm sure doesn't find me credible?
Yeah, yeah. So the good news is that even if you've had a terrible school year so far, you can start changing credibility tomorrow. Credibility comes down to a student's perception of CCP, okay? Do you care? Are you competent? And do you have passion? So care. Care is, students, the research says discern this in two ways at the same time. One, do you care about me as an individual? Like, could you care less that, you know, I've got a toothache or my mom has been sick lately? Do you care about me individually? But at the same time, do you care that I learn? Do you care that I achieve? Do you care about me, in other words, as a student? And we can start to affect this through a brief 30-second conversation tomorrow before class. You know what I mean? Pete, last time we talked about moments of genuine connection.
Mm-hmm.
And moments of genuine connection is something that's in the book. It's on the blog. I mean, if you Google it, you'll find it. But these are just brief moments where you're communicating to a child, hey, I see you. I value I'm trying to know you. I respect you. And so these are just, I use the word genuine on purpose. If we can establish this 30-second or 60-second encounter with a child, hey, how's it been going? What's going on? Tell me about where you're succeeding in school right now. Tell me about where you're not. Guess what? You're going to move the needle on that child's perception of the degree to which you care. It may not create, you know, transformational. It may not transform their behavior today, but those are the types of small micro investments that affect care. Hmm. Competence is harder, Pete, because being a competent teacher, as you know, is very difficult, yep. Right? But we just steadily work on managing our classroom more effectively until we get that skill down. We steadily work on mastering the content that we're tasked with teaching until we get that down. We work on how to deliver structurally sound lessons. Those are the arenas of competence. Hmm. Another might be just getting work back to students in a timely fashion. Those are where they make judgments about competence. And then finally, passion.
Yeah.
Three areas of passion. Do you care about what you've been tasked with teaching? Do you care about the young people that you're tasked with teaching it to? And do you care about the task of taking that content that you're required to teach and making it real and something that those students know and can master, right? Connecting the content to the kids. That's the third area that students need to sense that you're passionate about. And I would like to say that this is an area where we can grow. This is not fixed. If tomorrow you have to teach from a unit that you just hate, you find boring, then I want to challenge you. Find what's interesting there. Find what's interesting about that content. And if you can't do it with the content, then find what's interesting about the challenge of you teaching something that you don't personally find interesting to the young people in your care. But you have to find, this is work. I think too many of us just think, well, if I'm not default passionate about it, it's just not possible for that to change. And that's, I find, not true. Mm. So those three things, Pete, CCP, care, competence, and passion. We want to cultivate those in ourselves and do work to demonstrate those to our young people.
Yeah. Dave, what do you think about candor? In I'm thinking when you reference competence and how hard that one can be.
Yes.
You know, say I'm a teacher that my admin just kind of foreprepped me this year, you know, I'm struggling and I'm working as hard as I can, but trying to have a life at the same time.
That's right.
Where does candor fit into in credibility? Does it fit in there?
Candor absolutely fits into credibility, I think. Just being open about the struggles of what you're tasked with doing. And I would say candor with yourself, Pete. Mm. Hey, I'm forepreppt, and they're all new preps. This means that the way that I taught last year when I was single prepped is not going to be possible this year. Mm. It's not going to be humanly possible. So I need to have candor with myself to say, okay, then how are we drastically dialing down the way that I'm going to deliver this instruction around four preps?
Yeah.
Right? How can I work smarter, not harder here? Right? It may be every single class is going to have the same warm-up every day. Okay, or the same type of warm-up every day. And that's the only type of warm-up that we're going to use all year long. And maybe last year when I was single prepped, I had a different kind of warm-up every single day, and it was innovative and it was cool and it was so thoughtfully connected with the learning objective. But that is not going to be possible if you're going to try to have a life, which you should,
right?
And teach those four preps. So I would say that the candor begins, I think, internally. And then I think we can be, like, one way we demonstrate to our students that we care and are passionate is that when we mess up, we apologize. I believe that that's very powerful to a young person, especially an adolescent, to see an adult who's apologizing, not bitterly, not resentfully, and not begrudgingly, but just say, hey, yeah, you know, those papers, I really wanted to get those back to you a week ago, and I haven't. I just want to tell you guys, that's not acceptable to me. I'm working on improving this. So hang in there for me, okay?
Yeah. Value. So the value belief, you know, do our students find the work that we're doing valuable to them? Talk a little bit about that, Dave.
Well, I mean, anytime a child says, when am I ever going to use this in life? That's a value question. anytime that a young person says, you know, math is stupid, that's a value statement. A kid says reading is boring, that's about value. So there are two ways we can think about attacking value. One is from a position of credibility. This is why credibility rules them all. We can just communicate value to our kids. And I tell teachers, it's my goal personally to have 1,000 ways to explain why the study of world history is valuable. Why, even though no one's ever going to quiz you about Genghis Khan and the strengths and demerits of his approach, no one's ever going to quiz you on that. I didn't even know who Genghis Khan really was until I started to teach this class, and I'm a history minor from a university. Like, obviously, this is not critical for a large slice of the population. But even though that is the case, and I will openly say that to students, and I think that helps them to view me as credible, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm not trying to, you know, snow them. Like, yes, even though that's the case, no one's going to quiz you on this material someday. Here's 100 reasons why it's still valuable to do this work. Being the kind of person who can study Genghis Khan, even when you're not going to ultimately use it, but for the sake of just challenging yourself and having great discussions and writing really well about Genghis Khan, that kind of person who can do that is going to go on to succeed. So we should have 1,000 ways to explain why the stuff that we ask kids to do matters. But then the other way to approach it is have the kids tell you. So there's this researcher in Virginia named Chris Holloman, and he's got this exercise called Build Connections. Build Connections, we could put a link to that, you know, on the show page. But this is all freely available. But the thing with the Build Connections, what you're doing is you're having kids brainstorm how specific things that they've learned, you know, in the preceding few weeks, how those connect to specific things in their lives, hobbies, goals, aspirations, other people that they know. And then you're sitting there and you're having the kids discuss with one another and as a whole class, how does this relate to real life? So this is a student-generated value approach. And Holloman finds that those student-generated approaches are especially powerful for kids who enter the class thinking, this type of class is dumb. So he's done a lot of work with science students, and he finds that kids who have the Build Connections intervention, they are much more likely to say that they're interested in science careers at the end of the class, and they're much more likely to actually sign up for subsequent science work.
Interesting.
So those are two ways to think about it. Teacher-generated value arguments, and then student-generated value. I think that's kind of your 80-20 for approaching value in the classroom. But never again should you sit there and roll your eyes when the kid says, when am I going to use this? Never again. Because that's a child asking you, can you help me with the value belief? I don't currently have it. Can you help me? I mean, that's what they're saying.
Yeah. And I just have to point out, I like that you're not saying one of the acceptable answers is because we're going to test on it or because you're going to need this for next semester.
Yeah, that's not going to get you too far, right? I mean, because if someone came up to me and said, you know, in a professional development, when am I ever going to use this professional development? Well, it's on the evaluation rubric. I mean, that'll get me only so far, right?
Right.
And I'm being paid to teach.
Right.
So I have a little skin in that, like maybe it's going to move the needle for me a tiny little bit because it's connected to something that'll actually affect my life. But for our kids, I mean, a lot of our kids, especially kids who struggle with value, linking it to a grade, you know, is not going to probably move the needle too much.
Well, what you're doing there, I think, if you play that game, is you're trying to move the value question to that other thing, right?
Right, right.
So,
yeah, you're right.
So you're not really getting at the value of that content. You're saying, well, you should value this other thing, and so let's not worry about this.
Yeah, man. Yeah, a lot of teachers listening probably struggle with kids who value work only because of the grade. Right, or only because of the test. I have some of this in some of my classes. That's a poorly motivated student. That's why grade mongers or whatever you call them. That's why they drive us crazy because they're poorly motivated. They're not learning to learn. They're learning to receive a grade.
Yeah.
And so we can talk about that more with the efficacy belief because really that student is poorly defining success.
Yeah. All right. So belonging is next, kind of in the hierarchy here.
Yeah.
So we talked about this, again, briefly in our first conversation, Dave. as a former math teacher, I feel like I had this maybe more, I don't know, maybe not, but I felt like this one reared its ugly head often. I'm not a math student, right? I'm not that type of person.
That's right.
So I'm really fascinated to hear what you have for me on, okay, how do I, if it is malleable, how do I work on that one? How do I push on that?
Yeah. So again, when we have credibility, we can make statements like, I do this all the time to my students. Listen, I know out in the hallway, some kids might be saying, school is dumb, school is boring. We don't give credence to that type of philosophy. We don't speak like that, okay? We don't have that inside of us. And when we do find it, we root it out of us. So we can speak messages of belonging. We're the kind of people who apply ourselves in school. And if I was a math teacher, we're the kind of people who we wrestle with mathematics. We wrestle with it even when it's hard because there's value in being the kind of person who, when they see challenge, they don't cop out. They don't say, well, you know, I'm not really. No, we're the kind of people who take it on. Hmm. And we say, man, yeah, it's hard, but it can't be impossible. Other kids are doing it. Why can't I? Why not us? So those are ways that a teacher with credibility can try to affect the belonging belief. But Pete, it's crazy some of the studies they've done on the belonging belief. Like in one study, they, it's in mathematics. I think I have a link I'll give to you. Okay.
Sure.
We'll put it on the page, but it's basically a study where they had students in a math department, read something from a mathematician. And it's like, they listed the mathematician's birthday. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if the student in the study had the same birthday as a mathematician, and then in the control group, they did not have the same birthday. If they had the same birthday as a mathematician, they were more likely to say that they felt a sense of belonging in the math department.
Interesting.
Bizarrely tiny things can change our perceptions of belonging. So one way that we can affect belonging in our kids is, especially when we teach diverse populations, is make sure that they're seeing examples of people that they identify with, right? Male, female, different races, backgrounds. Make sure that they're seeing examples of different people who have math identities, who proudly say and have built flourishing lives on this idea of, yes, I'm a mathematician. Yes, I engage in mathematical work every day. So this would look like going out, maybe finding some brief TED Talks or biographies or something of that nature that represents all the students in your setting. To try to communicate to the kids, just, and in this case, it's, you're not directly telling them, you're showing them people like you, people with the way that you think about your identity, they do work like we do in here. So that's a way. And if you want to get really involved and really powerful, there's this whole line of studies around something called attributional retraining, which is basically interviewing upperclassmen students or students that are further ahead. And what you want to capture in these interviews is the fact that at first they felt like they didn't belong. So at first they felt like kids like them didn't do math, or they said, yeah, I'm not doing good in math, so therefore I must not be cut out for it. You want to capture kids who would say that and then have a transformation, then realize, oh, it's actually normal to struggle. Oh, it's once I stuck it out, I realized that I did belong. Mm. So those interventions tend to be very powerful. That's more work for the teacher. But I think what I just gave you is kind of a variety of, you know, a spectrum of effort levels for the teacher, and depends how much time you have and how aggressively you want to attack this belief.
Yeah. Dave, the fourth key belief is effort. And I find it interesting that it's kind of fourth on your list, because I do feel like this is the one we go, this is kind of the go-to
100%.
For teachers, that student isn't trying, that student doesn't give effort, that student. So I think what you're inherently saying is, hey, there's some other things that might be going on before we even get to effort. Is that right?
Absolutely, Pete. This belief is growth mindset.
Yeah.
And so this is also the most famous belief, the most popular belief, thanks to Carol Dweck's book. And so this is also the most misunderstood belief, like you're saying. Oh, the problem is these kids don't care. The problem is these kids don't try. The problem is they're not putting forth effort. But you gotta dial back a little bit, right, and attack these other beliefs if you even want to get them to the place where they're going to be willing to put forth effort.
Right.
But a key misunderstanding here, and the top thing that I harp on here, is we've got to teach kids what kind of effort to put in, right? So I teach this AP World History class for ninth graders. It's not a class that ninth graders are supposed to take. It's too hard, okay? But I advocated for this class because I believe that challenge is a powerful motivator. And I knew that the young people in our small town could do this. And I knew that it didn't have to be a select group of young people. It could be a pretty broad net, like as many as will fit in two sections, let's take them. If they want this, let's give it to them. And so what I've found in working with these kids for the past 4 years is that a lot of them are willing to put an effort, but it's unwise effort, okay? I guess will be a way to put it. They're going to sit there and they're going to read the night's reading and they're just going to highlight everything, okay? And that's not effort that the research suggests is going to actually enable you to recall that information later on or do anything complex with that information, you know? So I teach them how to take notes. And then what I'll find is students are taking notes for 2 hours each night, writing down practically every word in the reading. And so I have to teach them more about how to take notes that are shorter, notes that could serve as a study guide in the future. So I have to teach my students what kind of effort to put forth. What does wise effort look like? Because otherwise, even if I've got them motivated up to this point, I've got credibility and value and belonging, they're not going to tend to succeed because they're going to put in the wrong type of effort. And I think we as teachers, we tend to forget how much our kids need to be taught everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything. Don't tell them to go home and study.
Right.
Show them how to study. Walk them literally through studying in your class. And this can seem to a teacher like, well, I don't have time. I don't have time to do that. But what I would say is we don't have time to not do that.
That's right.
Because what we're going to end up doing is by not showing them how to study, showing them how to learn, we're going to end up having them do poorly on assessments. And then we're going to be chasing that all year long. We're going to be chasing these kids who aren't passing. We're going to be chasing these kids who haven't mastered previous information. And so it ends up being super overwhelming.
Yeah.
So teach effort. What does effort look like when it's wisely applied?
And David, it just hit me. I think we can see this quite clearly when you think of young children. So I have a 4 and a 6-year-old at home, and I'll catch myself sometimes, say my daughter is trying to draw a certain picture she's never drawn before, and she's getting frustrated, and I'll say, it's okay if it doesn't turn out right. I just want you to try.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
well,
right.
Well, very, very clearly, I can see that she doesn't know how to try.
Right? Yeah, right,
so,
right.
So just saying try, yeah, this is something I did all the time with my students. I'm here for you if you just try. I'm right. here for you if you just try.
Right.
Well, they don't know how.
Right. Right. And there's a tension there, right? Because
yeah.
because we do want to communicate to our kids. I mean, part of the effort belief is when it's not working out at first, you can figure out a strategy or you can advocate for yourself and have a teacher help you with the strategy to make your effort more impactful, to make it matter. So we as teachers, I mean, this is what I love about teaching. We get to sit there and discern, okay, does that child need to learn about self-advocacy right now?
Hmm.
And so do I just need to say something that's a little more passive, like, hey, I'm here Tuesdays and Wednesdays after school, and I think you should come in and so we can talk and look at your notes and talk about what's happening. So I'll be here. You just tell me when. That's a little more passive. A little mm-hmm. more aggressive would be, hey, come in this Tuesday after school or today at lunch. And with your child, I think, you know, and same thing with my kids, it's like, right now is the right call for me to step in and actually take her hand and show her, hey, well, you're trying to draw a circle right now.
Yeah.
Let me show you how to draw a circle. Let me give you something to think about, draw a circle. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like show her how to draw a circle. Or do I need to sit there and let her struggle?
Right.
And let her try to figure out strategies for drawing a circle on her own. I think that's the beautiful part of teaching. That's the artist part of teaching, is discerning that.
Okay, so last on our list is efficacy. Mm. So let's talk a little bit about experiencing success. What's going on there inside of our students, Dave?
Well, one thing is, and then we teased this. I teased this a little bit earlier. So let me just right now say, for our grade-obsessed kids, we want to work all year long to redefine success as something beyond the grade. I always say to my students, and this happens in my AP classes more than my on-level classes, who are obsessed with grades. Listen, all you need to worry about right now is mastering the material. That's why the assessments aren't going like you want. That's why the quizzes, the essays are not going like you want, because you haven't mastered it yet. So these are some strategies that you can use to help you gain greater understanding of this material, to be able to recall key information better and understand how that information connects. Those students need to redefine success as not the grade that they're going to receive, but mastery of the material. And what they find over the year as they shift to a mastery stance is that the grade follows.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And there's no magic bullets here. It's just communicating this consistently. Consistently communicating this. And I tend to, wherever I can, make my grading policies favor mastery, right? And there's some things that my department won't allow me to do in terms of mastery, and there's some things that my department will. So every teacher has different constraints here. But where you can, allow responsible retakes, or for me, responsible test corrections.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that unit one test in an AP class, I need you to master that material because it's going to come up again,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's important for mastering the overall course that you get unit one. And so I allow those test corrections because I want you to go back and figure out what went wrong. So we can define mastery as success, not a grade as success. We can have policies and think about how our policies communicate to students that, yes, in this class you actually can succeed, because it's not one and done.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing would just be, especially early on in the year, and I've gotten better at this with every year that I've taught with the five key beliefs in mind, is how are we ramping up? How are we slowly building students up or scaffolding them up to the level of challenge that we want them to succeed at? We really do want, in a class where all kids are motivated, to have all kids succeeding. Because success is very motivating, but that success needs to be challenging in order to be motivating, right? Like if you tell me to draw a stick figure right now, I succeed at it, it's not going to give me much motivational fuel.
Right.
So that's attention too. How do we make it so that in a class with diverse ability levels, we're slowly scaling up the level of challenge so that all of our kids, as many as possible, are succeeding as we ramp up? But then how do we make sure that that ramp is steep enough so that they're not getting bored or feeling like, oh, this class is so easy,
mm-hmm.
and therefore they're not going to be motivated? So those are the issues that come up with the efficacy belief.
Yeah. Dave, we got a few minutes left, and I do want to take some time to talk about the utility of the five key beliefs.
Yeah.
So let me tell you how I've been using them.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me how I can ramp that up.
All right, yeah.
So I've been primarily using the five key beliefs for diagnosis.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's really then it. And I've struggled a bit then, okay, what do I do now? Already I've been helped by hearing your thoughts on why there's a hierarchy here. That they're not necessarily all equal, or equal is not the right word, but that there's an order to these things so that they can kind of lay out in front of you a little bit more easily. But how can I go past just diagnosis? And first of all, is diagnosis one good way to use these, Dave?
Yeah, I like to think, Pete, that these are super useful for analysis or diagnosis and action, okay? Analysis and action. So on the one hand, the beliefs empower me as an educator to look at a poorly motivated student and say, okay, what's going on?
Right.
What's going on? And if I need to, I can ask some questions in a brief conversation to try to gain greater clarity. But do I sense that the kid just doesn't like me? Well, that's a credibility problem, right? Do I dig deeper and I see that they just ask them like, hey, you don't seem to really be, you know, doing work, right? Or if you're working with adults, you know, and they're sitting back there with their stack of papers, grading them and ignoring you, just trying to engage them in conversation, ask them a few guiding questions. Hey, I noticed you got some papers here. What's happening?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in an adult learning situation. I'm not that direct, you know.
Right,
we'll try to establish credibility just through like what I'm saying.
Right.
And that often wins the day.
Yeah.
And the papers go to the side. So like when working with adults, credibility is, I think, even more important than when working with kids, and it's huge with kids.
Sure.
So you now know, though, some ways to affect credibility, right? And so this is where I would encourage you to use analysis, use them to analyze motivational problems. But then, like in the first 5 minutes of a talk with adults, I'm trying to clearly establish credibility and the other five key beliefs, Yeah. Honestly, M. Pete, I do use this. Like I gave a keynote in Arkansas City a few months ago, and it's K through 12. Every employee in the building, there's transportation folks in there, food, everyone. And as I'm going through the first 5 minutes of this keynote, I'm just thinking, okay, how am I establishing these five things, right? So how am I establishing that I'm credible? How am I establishing, and sometimes with adults, it's just demonstrating my humanity,
yeah.
Right? It's demonstrating that I don't think that I'm up here, have it all together. But how am I also saying that the work, what we're going to talk about today is valuable? How am I speaking to where they might find value? Mm-hmm. How am I communicating that this is possible for everyone to succeed at? You know, that the bus driver can affect the key beliefs. So how am I speaking to that segment of the audience and help them see, oh yeah, these beliefs are malleable. These beliefs can change at every little interaction that these kids have in their day can affect the beliefs. So I think that they inform action too. That'd be my push for you, mm-hmm. is to sit there and take what we've talked about today, take that and say, okay, what can I do? Just to crank it up 1%. Excellent. Just 1%.
Excellent. Well, Dave, it's been a pleasure again chatting with you today. I understand there's some ways that teachers can learn more about student motivation and your work on the five key beliefs. So what are those ways?
So I've developed a student motivation course, Pete, and this is an all online, schedule friendly professional development that consists of 35 videos. Each one is 2 to 10 minutes long. So they're meant to, you know, you could fit a video into a prep period, and it doesn't need to take that whole prep period. But really, I designed the type of professional development that I had wished existed for me when I was wrestling around with this stuff and buried in, you know, hundreds of pages of research. Like, man, wouldn't it be nice if someone just sort of laid it out nice and neat? Someone who was in a classroom every day so they could make the research not just clear to me, but also practical, actionable tomorrow. And so that's the student motivation course, man. And that opens up, we're opening that on Friday, November 30th. For people listening to this right when it comes out, it's Friday, November 30th, and registration closes on December 6th. So we'll have a link to that on the show page. And I'd encourage people, if you're interested, advocate for the opportunity with your administrator so mm-hmm. that they'll help pay your way. And join us, because teachers around the world are going to be interacting with these ideas and applying them to their unique settings as soon as mid-December.
Well, Dave, it's been a pleasure. And until next time, I hope to do this again very soon.
That's right, Pete. Until next time, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that was Pete and Dave Stewart Jr. Once again, a great conversation. And Pete, I always appreciate what Dave has to share on not just student motivation, but education in general. He's got some profound things. And we've been talking quite a bit now about his five key beliefs particularly. And as he goes into it, one of the most interesting things to me is the hierarchy. And we talked about that earlier. Pete, what were your thoughts about how Dave prioritized these five key beliefs?
Yeah, Zach, I agree. I think that was the most interesting part of this conversation for me. And listeners, you might have been able to hear, I didn't know what he was going to say when I asked, hey, is there an order here? And no, he had thought about it. There's a very intentional order. And what I find so interesting is effort comes forth. You know, and it really is, like we talk about in the conversation, it is the go-to kind of belief or mindset for when students aren't working, right? We always say, well, they're just not trying.
Yeah.
What's so fascinating though is, you know, for him it's forth. You know, like we don't even talk about putting forth effort and trying, that kind of an intentional trying that he talks about, until we've talked about how credible we are, how valuable we're making the work, and the sense of belonging we're creating in our classroom. So that was the most interesting thing for me.
Absolutely, Pete. So what else? As you talk with Dave Stewart Jr. about these things, what else is standing out?
Well, yeah, you know, again, there's the reminder, Zach, that these things are malleable. You know, we don't have to have, as teachers and as educators, a fixed mindset about our students either. You know, there are things we can do to make ourselves more credible. There are things we can do to give value to the work There's things we can do to create a sense of belonging, you know, as a math teacher, like I mentioned in the episode. You know, I don't have to just say, well, yeah, some students are just going to say they hate math and they're not math students. No. There's things I can do. So I think it takes those subconscious excuses off the table for us that, you know, it's all on the kid and there's nothing I can do until they're willing to learn. No. There are things I can do to influence that kid. It might take a long time. And I think the order, I mean, I hate to come back to this again, but the order, the hierarchy is meaningful there too, because it gives me a place to begin. Do I have credibility with this student? If the answer is a maybe, that's the one I should work on.
Right.
If it's a yes, wholeheartedly yes, well then I go to the next one. Value. What's the work we're doing? Does it have value here? And I move on forth through the hierarchy that way. So super helpful.
Absolutely. And by adopting that perspective, it really allows for powerful and proven change. Pete, appreciate your time. And once again, thanks for listening to the episode. We hope you enjoy. You can certainly find more from Dave Stewart Jr. and the resources suggested by checking out the show notes and the description. Thanks again for listening. If you haven't yet deduced, at CBD, we believe the best kind of professional growth comes from conversations with other professionals. So we have devoted ourselves to ensuring any educator anywhere can have that opportunity. Our virtual coaching service guarantees that. Check us out on cbdconsulting.com/elevateedu. You can share thoughts with just an email or quick text, or dive right into a conversation by phone or video chat. We look forward to hearing from you.